At a sign from Fabrus, every guard in the courtyard drew his weapon and trained it on the proconsul's group. Of course, Erasian's men drew their disruptors at the same time. Not an unexpected development, the governor mused, but despite their response, the proconsul's men wouldn't fire on him. Not when it was likely to end in Erasian's demise. Of course, the proconsul's vessel could intervene, but Erasian would have to give the order first, and the governor's guards would make sure to prevent that. Tharis looked at Erasian meaningfully. Well, proconsul, it seems we have a difference of opinion. If I were you, I'd drop my weapon and surrender myself, but then you may prefer to die in a bath of disruptor energy instead. It's up to you. Erasian's mouth twisted. He hesitated, obviously reluctant to give up without a fight. But what choice did he have? None, the governor decided. Spock had observed the confrontation between Tharis and Erasian with acute interest. After all, his students' fates hung in the balance. Clearly, Erasian, like Tharis, had divined the Vulcan's presence here, or he wouldn't have demanded the prisoners so vehemently. But the proconsul was likely to show them no more mercy than the governor intended. Either way, the rebels seemed destined for execution. And Spock himself would become a tool in the dismemberment of the unification movement, unless he acted quickly. Reaching back, the Vulcan targeted the nearest guard and slugged him across the face, manacles and all. As the Romulan crumbled, his disruptor fell out of his hand. Spock picked it up, two-handed, and fired in the dirt at Erasian's feet. Reacting just as he'd hoped, the proconsul fired back. The Vulcan was on the move, however, and the beam missed. Discharging his weapon on the run, Spock hit the part of the gallows from which the nooses were suspended. The structure sizzled away into nothingness. As the executioners scrambled for cover, the rebels found themselves unhampered by either noose or guard. Instinctively, they turned to the Vulcan, who was resetting his weapon, to stun. Because by then, the seed he had planted by firing at the proconsul had taken root. Seeing that Erasian's bodyguard had opened fire, the governor's men had done the same. Now the two sides were exchanging disruptor blasts. Spock turned to the main body of rebels and held up his weapon in his hands, a symbol of hope and freedom. He saw the unflinching trust in their eyes as he pointed to the gate. Follow me. A moment later, Spock was crossing the courtyard in long, running strides. With every step, the gate was getting closer, but so were those who guarded it. Raising his weapon, the Vulcan released a blast at the sentinel to his right. The blue beam rammed into the Romulan, sending him sprawling out of sight. Before he could repeat the maneuver, he saw another beam take out the second sentinel. As the Romulan fell from his perch, Spock sought out the source of the beam and saw Scrasis, the pistol in his hand. Spock was about to remark on his student's accuracy when he saw the Romulan's expression change. He whirled to face a Romulan guard who had separated himself from the melee. A guard with a disruptor in his hand, the Vulcan had no time to avoid the blast. But before it could come, Spock felt a weight come slamming into him. It propelled him forward, out of danger. Still, the beam hit something or someone. Even as the ground rushed up at him, the Vulcan was turning back to see who had saved him. To his horror, it was Scrasis. In the background, Spock heard screams of agony and shouts of triumph. He glimpsed running and strife. But all that was secondary right now. His universe had narrowed its focus to the man writhing at his feet, his tunic burned away to reveal a horror of a wound. He would not let Scrasis die, he thought, as he knelt beside his student. He would not. Looking up, the Vulcan saw that the guard who'd fired at them was now coming closer, his disruptor aimed squarely at Spock, who was now weaponless. Scrasis gasped.
Save yourself, teacher.
Spock shook his head.
I am afraid that is no longer an option. Commander Hayjack shifted in the center seat and glanced back over his shoulder. This would not be a pleasant scene, he told himself. As Eragian emerged onto the bridge of the Vengeance, his face was a dark and dangerous green. Looking angry enough to strangle the first person who spoke to him, the proconsul barked a string of curses that would have burned the ears of the toughest centurion. My entire escort dead at the hand of Tharus's mongrels. I was lucky to escape.
True enough, thought Hayjack. His transporter operator had found it nearly impossible to locate Eragian. What with bodies and energy beams flying everywhere and no subspace broadcast to guide them. It was only when a distraction presented itself at the far end of the courtyard that they'd been able to identify the proconsul and extract him. Eragian pointed a finger at Hayjack.
Start transporting Tharus's men into our hold quickly before they kill the Vulcan.
Hayjack turned to his second in command.
See to it the proconsul's orders are carried out. I don't want a single guard left standing down there, and bring up Tharus as well while you're at it. As you wish, Commander.
But as he left the bridge, Hayjack's sensor officer and Darek called out.
Commander, our instruments have picked up a transport, and it did not originate from this vessel, or either of the others.
Hayjack crossed the bridge to join the woman at her station.
Then where did it originate? This quarter, sir. I was unable to pinpoint exact coordinates.
Hayjack looked at her.
A vessel under cloak?
Eragian joined him.
Who could it be, Hayjack? And what were they doing here? God, what if they're after Spock?
The commander shook his head. What in the name of the homeworld was going on here? He eyed his sensor officer.
Keep a watch, Andarica. See if you can detect another transport. And in the meantime, review your sensor logs. If a transport took place, the ship that affected it must have dropped its cloak for a fraction of a second. Of course, Commander.
As Andarica turned back to her duties, Hayjack again confronted the proconsul.
It will take time to locate the transporter device. They may not even attempt another transport if they've got what they wanted. And if they do attempt one, they will almost certainly be a moving target. It may take several transports before we can pinpoint them with any accuracy.
The proconsul paced like a caged animal.
And what if they depart before then?
Hayjack shrugged.
Then we will have to identify and track their ion trail. And if it is a more sophisticated vessel, our task will be that much more difficult. Should we not contact the others? No, Your Eminence. We do not want to alert the intruder by allowing him to intercept intership communications. The longer the enemy remains in the dark, the better it will be for us. Make sure this mystery vessel does not get away, Hayjack. Because if it does, I will have little to lose by stripping you of your command, and a good deal more.
The commander nodded soberly.
I understand, Your Eminence.
Still kneeling by his injured student, Spock looked up at the disruptor barrel and the guard who stood behind it.
Get up, rebel, or I'll burn down the two of you.
The Vulcan lifted his chin in passive defiance. I cannot. This one is hurt. He needs help. He had no illusion that the guard would sympathize with him. But then he didn't expect to live very long in any case. Taking a breath, he braced himself for the agony of the disruptor blast. But it never came. Because suddenly, the Romulan guard had disappeared. The entire courtyard was gone, replaced by what looked like the transporter room of a Federation starship, and an outdated one at that. However, Scrasis was still beside him, stretched out on the transporter pad. Certainly that was enough of a shock, but when Spock saw who was operating the transporter, he stared in open-mouthed amazement.
Mr. Scott?
Aye, sir. Unfortunately, there's no time for an explanation. I've had a few more passengers to take aboard. And without that broadcast to work with, I've got to rely on existing transporter locks.
Spock was still puzzled, but he understood the urgency of the situation. He lifted his student and hurried through the doors which parted at his approach. If there was still time to save Scrasis' life, he would try his best to do so. Unfortunately, he was no surgeon. Of all the times to be without Leonard McCoy. As Geordi sat at the Yorktown's helm, perspiration making wet trails down his neck, he waited for the go-ahead from the transporter room. Looking back over his shoulder, he saw that Commander Riker was perspiring too in the captain's chair. Only Data, who occupied the science station, was cool as could be. The android was checking out the Yorktown's cloaking device.
The cloak is still functioning, Commander, though it appears to be flickering each time Captain Scott attempts a transport.
Riker frowned.
That's to be expected, Data. I just hope the Romulans don't notice. It'd be inconvenient to have to.
We've got the last of them, lads. I'm on my way up to the bridge.
In a release of pent-up energy, Riker brought his fist down on the armrest of his chair.
Engage, Mr. LaForge. Get us the hell out of here.
Deftly, Geordi took the ship out of orbit. Riker spoke up again.
Engage warp drive. I'll take the best speed you can wring out of those old engines.
Geordi checked his instruments.
Looks to me like warp 8.
But a voice behind him had other ideas.
Make that 8.15, laddie.
Geordi turned and saw Captain Scott emerging from the open turbo lift. Coming up alongside the captain's chair, the older man eyed Riker. The first officer began to stand until Scotty stopped him.
Stay where you are, Mr. Riker. After all, you're the one with all the combat experience.
Of course, Scotty had some combat experience of his own, but clearly he felt he was needed more elsewhere. Without another word, Scotty sat down beside him at navigation. Geordi nodded.
8.15 it is.
Pushing the warp drive just a little harder, he scanned his monitors. The engines seemed to be handling the additional load, just as Scotty had predicted. Geordi eased himself back into his seat. With luck, the hardest part was behind them. His thoughts were interrupted by an explosive curse from Captain Scott.
We've got company, lads!
Checking the tactical monitors on his console, Geordi saw what Scott was talking about. A moment later, Scott made it easier for him by placing the image on the forward view screen.
Three Romulan warbirds, they must be tracking us by our ion emissions. It seems we were ne'er the only vessel circling Castanthus under cloak.
Riker shook his head.
We're not going to outrun them, but they're not going to take us without a struggle either. Mr. LaForge, evasive maneuvers, Riker Alpha.
Geordi worked the helm controls, but he knew it wouldn't make any difference. They didn't have enough tricks up their sleeves to get them all the way to the neutral zone in one piece.
Perhaps I may be of assistance.
Geordi looked back over his shoulder to see who'd spoken. Riker turned to the newcomer.
If you've got any ideas, Ambassador Spock, I'm sure we'd all be glad to listen to them.
Spock cocked an eyebrow.
In that case, I recommend we stop all engines immediately.
Geordi was about to balk at the idea until he saw the sense in it. Apparently, Riker saw it too.
All stop.
The Yorktown shuddered as it dropped out of warp, taxing the century-old inertial dampeners to their limit. The warbirds, unable to anticipate the Yorktown's move, were hard-pressed to keep from smashing into her. As it was, they only missed by a couple of dozen meters. Riker cried out,
Target photon torpedoes! Let's go for the one in the middle, Captain Scott! Fire!
Twin packets of photon fury erupted in the direction of the Romulan, and at this intimate range, the enemy's shields didn't stand a chance. Data turned to Commander Riker.
Direct hits on their starboard weapons bank. Damage is isolated, but considerable.
Scotty chuckled.
They'll be firing at us with those wee bairns.
Spock looked only vaguely satisfied with himself as he made his next suggestion.
Ahead impulse engines.
Riker seemed to know what Spock was thinking.
Full impulse, Mr. LaForge. On my mark, accelerate to warp 8.3 and come as close as you can to one of the warbirds.
Surge to impulse speed wasn't bad, especially for an old ship like this one. But going to warp would be a different story entirely. Spock made his way to the navigation console and sat down beside the engineer. On the view screen, the Romulans were nowhere to be seen. Suddenly, they appeared as specks in the distance, and before Geordi knew it, they were filling the parameters of the screen. Riker's eyes narrowed.
Target photon torpedoes! Engage warp engines!
As Geordi activated the warp drive, the Yorktown leaped forward, thrusting him back into his seat, but not before he guided them to within a whisker of one of the warbirds. As luck would have it, the Romulan barrage missed the Yorktown entirely. Riker gave the order.
Fire!
As before, the Yorktown sent a pair of torpedoes after the warbirds at point-blank range. And as before, the torpedoes nailed one of them, caving in its shields in the process. Data looked up.
Direct hits, Commander. We have incapacitated another weapons bank.
But they weren't out of the woods yet. They'd bought themselves a head start. But the warbirds were still faster than the Yorktown. And now that they'd been burned twice, they'd be more calculating in their next attack. Just as Geordi was thinking these things, the situation got worse. Much worse.
We're losing warp speed, Commander. Looks like a problem with the powered transfer conduits. The strain of that last maneuver was too much for them.
In other words, the Yorktown just wasn't built for such stress. Not even when it was new. Scotty sighed.
We can at least reduce power to non-essential systems. That'll keep us going a wee bit longer.
Toward the end, they disengaged their cloaking device. Then the weapon systems. But they were still losing speed. Data looked up.
The Romulans are catching up, Commander. At our present rate of deceleration, they will be in torpedo range in 54 seconds.
Riker had them take the shields offline except for rear and aft deflectors. But they were still slowing down. The first officer sighed.
Cut power to life support.
Geordi shook his head helplessly. That would only buy them another second or two. They were down to warp 4 and dropping. Warp 3.5. Warp 3. Scotty grunted sadly.
30 seconds, lads.
Geordi looked to his fellow engineer. There was nothing more they could do, and both of them knew it. Data resumed his countdown.
20 seconds. 15. 10.
Geordi held onto the console in front of him. He had no doubt the Romulans would fire as soon as they were in range. The ship's computer voice piped up.
This exhibit is now closed. Please watch your step on the way out.
Data ignored it.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Abruptly, Geordi felt something slam into them from behind, rattling his teeth. His control panel showed that they'd sustained a torpedo, and it happened again. Except the impact was even greater, and again. Behind Geordi, the communications console burst into flame. The deck plates groaned in his ears. As the ship jerked again, sparks exploded from the science station, driving Data backward against the rail. The Yorktown was dying, Geordi realized. They were going to die along with him. My God, thought McCoy. We're too late. On the Battle Bridge's viewscreen, the Yorktown staggered under the weight of a dozen fiery photon torpedoes. Standing beside Worf at the tactical station, in the lurid light of a red alert, the Admiral wanted to do something, anything. But he was out of his element. Picard leaned forward in his seat.
Report, Mr. Worf. The Yorktown has sustained significant damage to several sections of her hull. Sensors show no casualties as yet, but all systems are offline. Another such attack will threaten the vessel's structural integrity.
In other words, the Admiral thought, there's nothing but spit and baling wire keeping her together. He muttered a curse. After all, his friends were on that ship. It occurred to McCoy that they could still beam the Yorktown's people aboard, but only if they dropped their own shields or tried to extend them around the smaller vessel. And right now, that just didn't seem practical. The captain stood up and addressed the ensign at the con station.
Ensign Middleton, position us between the Yorktown and the Warbirds.
A moment later, the Enterprise swung into the space in front of the wounded starship, offering her some measure of protection. But at the same time, it made the larger vessel an easier target. Nor did it take the Romulans long to figure that out. In a heartbeat, they were looping into a new configuration, one meant to take advantage of the Enterprise's defensive posture. Picard turned to Worf.
Program a standard torpedo spread, fire on my mark. Admiral McCoy, I'd find a seat if I were you.
The Admiral didn't have to be told twice. He made a beeline for an empty seat at one of the aft stations, just as Middleton spoke up.
Captain, two of the Romulans have already sustained damage to their weapons banks. If we could...
The captain stopped her with a gesture.
Noted, Ensign. Mr. Worf, belay the standard program, focus all your attention on the alternative weapons capabilities of those two vessels, and prepare the way with surgical phaser strikes.
McCoy was familiar with the strategy. First, create a weak spot in the enemy's shields with concentrated phaser fire, then follow up with a swarm of photon torpedoes. If one got through, it would wreak havoc, but it wouldn't be easy. And Picard was calling for two targets, not one. That raised the difficulty factor. On the view screen, meanwhile, the warbirds looked thirsty for blood as they dove headlong toward the Enterprise. The captain raised his chin as if in defiance of the odds. This wasn't at all the same man McCoy had tongue-lashed for his lack of initiative. This was a seasoned warrior, unflinching in the heat of battle.
Fire!
As the Romulans shot past them, the energy exchange was fast and furious. It filled the screen with a blinding white light and made the deck jerk beneath their feet. And when it was over, they were still in one piece. And judging from Worf's exclamation, they might even have gotten the best of the encounter.
Shields are down 75%, Captain. But all systems are still functional, and we've sustained no casualties.
They'd been lucky, McCoy mused. At this range, under that kind of firepower, he'd known entire crews to be destroyed. The captain absorbed the information.
And the Romulans, Mr. Worf? Direct hits on the two previously damaged vessels, we have all but destroyed their weapons capabilities.
But the third vessel had gone unscathed. That was the trade-off. Middleton turned to Picard.
They're coming back for another pass, sir.
Picard considered the viewscreen, his eyes narrowed with resolve.
Let them, Ensign.
It wasn't as if he had any choice, given the poor condition of the Yorktown. Still, the Admiral liked the captain's style. Picard didn't waver as the warbirds loomed on the screen.
Target the third vessel only, Mr. Worf. As before, phasers and torpedoes, but this time, give it everything we've got. Our objective remains the same. It's weapons banks. Targeted and ready, sir.
The Admiral clenched his teeth. The captain was gambling everything on this next roll of the dice. But he couldn't budge from his position, and the Romulans knew it. The question was, could they take advantage of it? Hobbled as they were, was the warbird's brute force greater than that of the Enterprise? Picard glared at the view screen.
Fire!
Predictably, their adversaries had the same idea. The view screen lit up with blast after mind-searing blast until even its built-in light dampers couldn't disguise the fury of the Romulan attack. The ship lurched, the bulkheads shrieking with the strain of impact after impact. Tearing loose of his control panel, McCoy felt himself pitch forward until something grabbed him from behind. Looking back, he saw that it was Worf. Reeling the older man in, the Klingon held on for both of them. A geyser of sparks erupted from one of the aft stations, sending its operator reeling in pain. The battle bridge was an ember-shot vision of hell. And through it all, Picard was a beacon of hope, somehow staying on his feet just forward of the command center. As the view screen cleared, it seemed to relent before his scrutiny, showing him the Romulan ships in a ragged retreat. The captain didn't call for a damage report. He just made his way to the ops console.
Repair crews to decks 13 through 16, trauma teams to deck 12.
The doctor in McCoy felt compelled to go with the trauma teams, but the admiral in him was peering at the tactical board, assessing the rest of their situation. The shields were down to nothing, but most everything else was still in working order. Picard looked to Worf.
What about the Romulans, Lieutenant? We accomplished our objective, sir. The third ship has only a single weapons bank still operational. The rest of its offensive capabilities have been disabled.
The captain nodded.
Then we've got a chance.
If we can capitalize on it. Lock tractor beams on the Yorktown, Mr. Worf. Let's see if we can't...
Middleton turned to Picard, eyes wide.
Sir, there are more of them on the way, bearing 242, Mark 4.
The captain's mouth became a thin, hard line.
Rear view, Ensign.
A moment later, the image on the view screen changed. Instead of three Romulan vessels in disarray, it showed three new ones, whole and eager for battle. That made it six against one, or against two, if one included the crippled Yorktown. McCoy felt a deep pang of disappointment. They'd almost made it, but with numbers like these, they didn't stand a chance. Picard felt empty inside. His people, his ship, they had done everything he'd asked. Now his only option seemed to be surrender.
The Romulans are hailing us, Captain.
On screen, Lieutenant.
In an eye blink, the image of the newly arrived warbirds gave way to that of a Romulan official. What's more, Picard recognized the face.
Proconsul Aragian.
The proconsul smiled.
I see you remember me, Captain. I'm flattered. Now lower what remains of your shields and prepare to be boarded.
The very idea went against Picard's grain. On the other hand, to do otherwise would be to seal the deaths of the battle section's crew, not to mention those on the Yorktown. There was nothing left but to ask for terms and hope that Horatian would grant them. Just then he felt a hand on his arm. Turning, he saw Admiral McCoy standing beside him.
Let me try something, Captain.
The captain looked at him. The last time McCoy had tried something, he'd made a mess of things. But there was something in the man's expression that encouraged optimism this time. Besides, what did they have to lose?
All right, Admiral. Good luck.
McCoy moved closer to the view screen.
I don't think we've met, Proconsul. My name is McCoy, Admiral Leonard McCoy, and I'd like to suggest an alternative to this combat we've engaged in.
How thoughtful of you, Admiral McCoy. And why would I entertain one of your suggestions when I so clearly enjoy the upper hand at this juncture?
McCoy shrugged.
Well, as we've pointed out before, these unificationists present a problem to you, and you could solve that problem by letting us slip away with them. That way the Federation gets to sweep an embarrassment to Vulcan under the rug. You, Proconsul, come out smelling like a rose. The only loser in all of this would be our friend, Governor Tharis.
Horatian didn't flinch at the mention of Tharis, nor did he seem particularly excited by the human's offer.
I could turn my weapons on you and accomplish the same thing, could I not?
McCoy didn't seem to be taken aback by the Romulan's response.
You're absolutely right, Proconsul. The problem is, that would almost certainly be the start of a shooting war between the Empire and the Federation. And unless I miss my guess, the Empire has devoted a significant number of ships to its conflict with the Stug.
Horatian's face seemed to lose some color.
The Stug?
The Admiral nodded.
I see you've heard of them. Then you must also know the Stug are united for the first time in many years. Something about a planet-wide tricentennial celebration, I believe. As a result, they'll be out for Romulan blood. Now, I'm no military strategist, Proconsul, but I'd imagine with the Stug on the warpath, the Empire would be in especially poor shape to defend itself against the Federation. That is, if somebody had the bad sense to stir things up.
Horatian swallowed hard.
I admire your grasp of the situation, Admiral.
It took the Romulan another few seconds to come to terms with his truncated range of options. No doubt he hated the idea of giving up Spock. But in life, one sometimes had to do the things one hated. Horatian lifted his chin.
What if I were to grant you safe passage as far as the neutral zone? That would seem to serve both our purposes, would it not?
McCoy's expression became one of gratitude.
That would be downright neighborly of you.
Horatian made a gesture with his hand.
It is done.
McCoy grinned.
Then I guess I'll be on my way. Don't take any wooden nickels, Proconsul. McCoy out.
Picard saw the image on the view screen change again. Once more, he was looking at the Romulan formation, except this time, half the warbirds were coming about. As he watched, they diminished with distance. Stepping forward, the captain placed his hand on McCoy's shoulder.
Good work, Admiral.
McCoy dismissed the idea.
I was lucky, that's all. I'm a doctor, not a diplomat.
The captain smiled.
You may be a doctor, but you are also a great deal more than that.
Then, taking his leave of McCoy, he addressed himself to the business of getting home. It wasn't the first time Spock had seen a badly damaged bridge. However, the Yorktowns looked painfully familiar. It reminded him of the Enterprise's bridge before its destruction.
Mr. Spock!
The Vulcan turned to his companion, who barely looked a day older than when Spock had seen him last, though that was more than 75 years ago.
You look distracted, sir. Are you sure you're all right?
I am fine, Mr. Scott. I apologize if I seemed unattentive for a moment. Appearances to the contrary, I was listening to every word you said.
Before he could complete his statement, Admiral McCoy emerged from the turbolift.
I wouldn't believe him if I were you, Scotty. Ancient as he is, the man still hasn't learned any manners.
Spock considered Leonard McCoy now as wizened and white-haired as any human he had ever seen.
As I indicated to Captain Scott, Doctor, I heard every word he uttered.
The Vulcan turned to Scotty.
It was then that you intercepted the subspace message concerning my captivity?
Scott smiled.
That it was, sir. And having heard it, I could ne'er sit back and let Starfleet worry about retrieving you. Not while there was someone around who still knew what he was doing.
McCoy grunted.
Make that two of you who knew what you were doing. I've got a newfound respect for that fella Picard. He may not be Jim Kirk, but he's all right in my book.
The Vulcan was reminded of how highly Sarek had spoken of Picard.
And in mine, Doctor. I see now why my father placed so much trust in him.
Scott turned to McCoy.
Do not sell yourself short, Doctor. I heard the way you put two and two together regarding the Stug and the lack of Romulans patrolling the neutral zone. If you had ne'er thought of that, we might all be guests on the Proconsul now.
Spock agreed.
It was a most clever ploy. At least Captain Picard seemed to think so. Nor was there anyone else on the Enterprise who could have executed it.
The Admiral seemed uncomfortable accepting a compliment from his old sparring partner.
In other words, it pays sometimes to be older than the hills.
Turning to his other colleague, Spock changed the subject.
I am intrigued by your survival in a transporter unit, Captain Scott. I found some of the details in a library file, but they were rather sketchy.
Scotty filled him in, describing his vessel's crash on the surface of a Dyson sphere.
Everything was disabled except auxiliary life support and communications. And even they were fading fast, so I melded the transporter circuits, locking the pattern buffers into a perpetual diagnostic cycle, and then had the computer cross-connect the phase inducers to the emitter array.
The Vulcan pictured the maneuvers.
And by doing so, you created a regenerating power source which could keep the mechanism operating until assistance arrived.
Exactly, sir. Of course, I did not expect it to take 75 years, but I suppose I should be glad it arrived at all.
Spock nodded.
Fascinating.
It made the engineer smile.
You know, Mr. Spock, I've waited a long time to hear you say that, and it was well worth it.
McCoy shook his head.
Speak for yourself.
The Vulcan sighed. Some things, it seemed, would never change. As Picard entered 10 forward, with Riker at his side, his gaze was drawn to the 23rd century vessel keeping pace off their starboard beam. Somewhere on that ship, Spock and his old comrades were enjoying a reunion of sorts. It was something about those three that distinguished them from other people, he thought.
Camaraderie.
His first officer turned to him.
I beg your pardon, sir.
The captain indicated the Yorktown with a lifting of his chin.
Those three over there, they exemplify the meaning of camaraderie like no one else I've ever seen.
Riker grunted.
I see what you mean, but then they served together for a long time, almost 30 years, wasn't it? Still friends? Still willing to risk their lives for one another?
Not so long ago, the being called Q had shown the captain a future that might yet take place. In it, Picard had seen his friends at odds with one another. Later, he'd sworn not to let matters run that course. Now the value of avoiding such a future was brought home to him even more resoundingly. The captain very much wanted his officers to be like Spock, McCoy, and Scott 30 years hence.
What can I get for you, gentlemen?
Turning, Picard saw Guinan herself standing behind the bar. He smiled.
Ale, please. Number one. A Dulian twist. Spicy, the way I like it.
And before he'd quite gotten the words out, Guinan had produced a foamy mug of ale and a rusty-colored drink in a tall, slender glass. Riker turned to the captain.
You can't beat the service around here.
Picard agreed.
For that reason alone, it was worth rejoining the saucer section.
Guinan looked at them.
So what happened to those charges? Captain Scott's not going to be court-martialed, is he?
Riker shook his head.
The captain pulled a few strings at Starfleet Command. Seems it's not the first time anyone's stolen a ship for a good cause.
Picard nodded.
True.
I understand in Captain Scott's day it happened all the time, of course. I had to promise Starfleet that he would refrain from such thefts in the future. Riker looked past Picard to the Yorktown. They've been out there for hours already. Probably so glad to see each other, we'll never be able to pry them apart. Guinan had to stifle a snicker. The captain shot her a glance.
What's so funny, Guinan?
Still giggling, she put a hand over her mouth.
Nothing, Captain. Nothing at all.
Spock cocked an eyebrow.
An emotional act? I must confess, Doctor, I do not see how...
McCoy grasped the red-orange rail surrounding the command center.
Don't give me that eyebrow, Spock! You know you didn't have a spacer's chance of stopping the execution, but that didn't keep you from belting your guard under the middle of next week. Or were your Romulan friends fibbing about that in the debriefing?
The Vulcan frowned.
Remember, Doctor, at the time, my only alternative was to allow myself and my comrades to be killed. It is hardly an emotional response to act to prevent such a result.
McCoy grunted disparagingly.
You gave in to an emotion, Spock. It happens to all of us at one time or another, except the rest of us admit it.
Spock looked at him. He reflected on his experiences with the Constanthrines in Tharys' prison, especially on the way they had refused to point him out, even when their lives hung in the balance. He had tried to teach his students the value of objectivity and the belief that they could aspire to nothing greater. And all the while, without realizing it, they had been teaching him the value of something just as important. The Vulcan sighed.
I must admit, emotion may have played some small part in my actions.
McCoy looked at him incredulously.
Call security, Scotty. Someone's impersonating Mr. Spock.
The Vulcan eyed his former colleagues.
You may find my statement humorous, gentlemen. However, I should note it was not human emotion that shaped my behavior, but rather Romulan emotion. You see, I began my efforts toward reunification thinking I had to teach Romulans to be Vulcans. Now, I see the value of combining the best qualities of both peoples.
McCoy chuckled.
I think we're making some progress here. If the ambassador's sampling Romulan emotion, I don't think human emotion can be too far behind. Tell you what, Spock. After you've gotten settled, we'll spend some time on Earth. Remind you of those human qualities you've been missing the last few years.
I would like to do that, Dr. McCoy. Unfortunately, that is not possible. You see, I have made plans to return to Romulus. I have already made the necessary arrangements with Captain Picard.
Scotty stared at him, horrified.
But it was nearly impossible to get you out, sir. Getting you back in could be twice as hard.
The Vulcan had an idea to the contrary.
There is a network I helped establish, which from time to time smuggles Romulan dissenters out of the Empire. I will employ the same network to smuggle myself and my students back to Romulus.
McCoy looked crestfallen.
You can't do this, Spock. You're too old to go risking your life in that den of snakes.
Scott agreed.
Oh, you've done enough, sir. You've done more than enough. Let someone else lead the unificationists.
If I am as old as you claim, gentlemen, there is little time for me to leave the galaxy better than when I entered it. Besides, two brave and resourceful men risked their lives to preserve the leader of the unification movement. How can I allow such an effort to be wasted?
McCoy's eyes took on a liquid cast.
You're a damned fool, Spock. Still... But I'll be rooting for you just the same.
Scott swallowed.
Oh, and we'll meet again, Mr. Spock. You can bet the whole blasted Romulan Empire on that.
Inwardly, the Vulcan smiled at his friend's optimism.
I would not be so foolish as to accept that wager, Mr. Scott.
Picard entered 10 forward just in time to see the starship Gettysburg come about in space. Describing a graceful arc,
The vessel moved away from the Enterprise under impulse power only, then switched to its warp drive and sped off like a shot. Crossing the lounge, he joined McCoy, Scott, and Data, who had gathered at an observation port to observe Ambassador Spock's departure. After all, the hopes and dreams of two worlds traveled with the Vulcan. Data turned to Picard. He looked surprised.
I believe I have experienced a premonition, sir. I have the distinct impression that we will see Ambassador Spock again.
Scott clapped Data on the shoulder.
I would not be surprised, Commander. After all, the Ambassador has a habit of returning from places you do not expect him to return from.
Picard understood the reference. After all, he'd had the advantage of mind-melding with Sarek shortly before the Elder Vulcan's death. McCoy looked at Picard.
I guess I owe you an apology, Captain. You knew what you were doing from the start, and I was a cranky old fool who couldn't...
Picard held up a peremptory hand.
I don't know about that. To my mind, it was the decisive action we took that ultimately made our mission a success. The kind of action you were advocating all along, Admiral.
McCoy smiled as he saw what the captain was getting at.
Tact and toughness. I suppose you've got to have both options in your arsenal if you're going to command a starship these days.
Picard smiled back. I suppose you do. Together they watched the stars shiver in the direction of the neutral zone, as if in anticipation of a renewed bond between Romulans and Vulcans. Of course, it might take a lifetime to bring the two races together again. It might not happen at all. But, the captain mused, if he and Admiral McCoy could work out their differences, anything was possible.
Star Trek: The Next Generation, Crossover, was written by Michael Jan Friedman and read by Jonathan Frakes. It was abridged for audio by Michael Jan Friedman. The recording engineer was David Knight at Tsukuto Audio. Digital editing by Steve Deutsch and Gary Fink. Post-production and sound design by Gary Fink. The associate producer was Florence Burrow Adams. Star Trek: The Next Generation, Crossover, was produced and directed by Linda Woolman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Michael Jan Friedman's Star Trek: The Next Generation, All Good Things, read by Jonathan Frakes.
This starship adventure is now over. Please take all wrappers and refuse with you when you leave. Thank you, and enjoy your next starship adventure.